the exporting country, the exporting industry, can say, look, you don't have enough science to justify that. The precautionary principle, the idea that you shouldn't do something until you can prove it's safe, is not part of the World Trade Organization rules. That's not an acceptable basis to regulate. And unless you repeal that regulation or don't implement it, we're going to get the United States or some other country to bring a trade case against you in the WTO. And that's a very, very powerful threat, first, because the countries know they're likely to lose, and second, because the sanctions, the penalties that the WTO doles out are significant, and quite harmful. And that's actually fairly complicated thing to talk about, how the sanctions work, so I'll skip over that. But they are costly to the defendant country. And it's had a serious damping effect on all kinds of regulations, ranging from recycling to trying to deal with electronics disposal safety issues. So let me switch, just with that sort of background, switch to the third point, which is this issue of the pharmaceutical industry, and how the pharmaceutical industry has used the panoply of trade agreements to push its agenda internationally. This is a different part of the story than what I would guess Ronnie talked to you about last night, or what was covered in the panel I was at this morning on biotechnology. It's much more of a sort of the consumer side rather than the abuse of biotechnology affecting the producer side of farmers and so on. Well, let me just say that the base, as background, I mean, what's at stake is whether poor people in developing countries can get access to pharmaceuticals. The pharmaceutical industry wants the right to charge whatever it wants to anybody in the world, and if people can't pay for pharmaceuticals that might be life-saving, then they don't get them, and then they die. That's the pharmaceutical industry point of view of this stuff. And their remedy for that problem is that they'll make some donations from time to time to address the issue. But they're not interested in structural approaches that might lead to developing countries gaining the ability to produce pharmaceuticals on their own without having to depend on charity and gifts from the industry. So that's really what's at stake. And it's almost impossible to exaggerate the significance of this. Just to take the example of HIV/AIDS, which I'll come back to in more detail in a second. There is what's quite literally an epidemic in Africa, as well as elsewhere, of HIV/AIDS. Nothing like what's here, much more significant. So in South Africa, 1 out of 8 people are HIV positive. In Kenya, it's about 1 out of 7. In Zimbabwe, 1 out of 4 people are HIV positive. Now, as you know, or may know, a lot of people who are HIV positive here, or people with AIDS, are able to live relatively normal lives through access to a drug cocktail, a bunch of different drugs put together. The drug regimen may cost about $30,000 a year in the United States. Mostly it's paid for by insurance, and it varies. Some people have great difficulty with it, but a lot of people are able to live pretty good lives on this drug regimen. But that's completely out of reach in Africa. And the question is, can African countries, or Asian countries, or Latin American countries do anything about it? And here's a story about whether they can or they can't, and how the trade agreements fit into the whole thing. The core issue is the issue of intellectual property, and for pharmaceutical companies, it's one part of intellectual property, it's patent rights. Now, a patent, as you probably know, gives the patent holder complete control over the use of an idea for 20 years after filing. So when a drug company takes out a patent on a new product in the United States, historically, for quite some time, it used to be 17 years in the United States. They would have 17 years, or now 20 years, of full protection for that. No one else can make that product without permission from their patent holder. And the idea behind a patent, is some of you may be familiar, is you want the company, say Bristol-Myers Squibb. Bristol-Myers Squibb, let's pretend they invented a new drug instead of took it from the U.S. government. They had a patent, and they invented a new drug. We want the idea of that new drug to be disseminated to the public. So we give them the incentive to do that by having them register it and take a patent out on it. That requires publishing the basis of the invention, so everybody in the world can see what the invention is. But Bristol-Myers Squibb, as the incentive to doing that, gets 20 years protection. And the idea is, well, we want them to have that protection because that gives them the incentive to have done the research in the first place, and research is good because it leads to good things, like the drug that Bristol-Myers Squibb and the hypothesis just invented. Now, patents have been around for a long time. They're in the U.S. Constitution, but haven't been in every country's constitution. And in fact, every developing country in the world has relied on copying of patents to develop industry. every developing country, like including the ones that have now left the status of developing and are now industrialized. So also the United States and all of Europe. A number of European countries didn't have patent laws for pharmaceuticals until the 1970s, for example. And much of the developing world, the now developing world, didn't have patent regimes for pharmaceuticals at all up through the negotiation of the GATT agreement, of the new GATT agreement in the late 80s and 90s. And if they did, they had different kind of variations. Like maybe they didn't give 17 or 20 years patent protection. Maybe they gave 10 years patent protection. Or in India, they gave protection not to the product that was produced, but only to the process. So if you invented a new drug, you'd patent the way you made that drug. If somebody else could figure out a different way to make that drug, they could also make it. And in the countries that had less strict patent protections, which would include India, Turkey, Argentina, and Brazil, domestic industry grew up because domestic industries in those countries were able to copy the products that were made, that had been patented in the United States or in Europe. And they were able to make them more cheaply, or at least they took less profit on them. And consumers in those countries benefited because there was wider access to pharmaceuticals at more affordable prices. And so the U.S. companies and the European companies in the pharmaceutical industry looked around the world and said, well, that's not so good. We don't like that. Those are sales that could be ours. And how come this domestic company in Brazil or Argentina is taking away our sales? So they led a campaign, a real strong political campaign, to reverse that. And they used a variety of trade tools. And it's interesting to look at how they went about reversing that, as they've largely done around the world. And I think one interesting thing about this is that there's nothing inherent. I mean, the way the world is now is that most countries do have these strong patent rules, or they're about to adopt them. But it wasn't that way not very long ago, and it didn't have to be that way, and it still doesn't have to be that way. So one of the really important lessons is that political organizing works. Political organizing for the pharmaceutical industry worked. They did a really good job of it. And when citizens do a good job of organizing, we can stop these things or undo them. So that's really our challenge. In the NAFTA agreement, there was a provision that required the three country parties to adopt U.S.-style patent laws. So Canada and Mexico had to bring their patent laws into conformity with the United States. That was a big deal because in Canada, they didn't have the same kind of patent regime we had here. They had a system of compulsory licensing, which I'll describe in more detail later. But it enabled basically companies to copy products if they paid a license, if they paid a royalty fee to the patent holder. And as a result, Canada had drug prices that were far below those of the United States. That was
wiped away. Canada agreed to undo that law actually it wasn't joining NAFTA, it was joining the U.S.-Canadian Free Trade Agreement, which was what preceded the three-country agreement. Then the U.S. industry got the U.S. Trade Representative, which is the agency that does trade negotiations for the United States and also imposes trade sanctions on other countries, to undertake unilateral action, to impose trade sanctions on countries that were determined not to have substantially stiff intellectual property rules. And so they did that against Brazil, they did that against Argentina, and they did that against Thailand, among other countries. And that helped nudge these companies forward. But it really wasn't enough. It was too slow. One at a time wasn't getting the job done. Too many countries were still slipping out of the grasp of the U.S. and the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association. So they said, look, we've got to take this agenda global. We've got to get it done in one shot. And they infused the agenda of the industry into the negotiations over the GATT, and which led to the World Trade Organization. So they created a separate section in the GATT negotiations for something called TRIPS, which is trade-related intellectual property rights. And the TRIPS section is a standalone agreement, part of the GATT agreements, but it's its own internal agreement. And in it, it was in fact drafted by the U.S. industry. There was a U.S. trade association called the Intellectual Property Rights Association, which is now disbanded. But in its materials, it indicated that it drafted the U.S. position, which then became the final text with only some relatively minor variations. So they had decisive influence over the drafting of the WTO section that most mattered to them, this TRIPS section. And in it, they required every country that was a signatory to adopt U.S.-style patent laws, which are the strictest kind of patent laws. Actually, quickly, the dispute turned into an issue only over how long the transition period would be for poor countries to switch to U.S.-style laws. So when the negotiations got really bare-knuckled and nasty, it was, should they have to do this in 2 years and have to do it in 10 years, which wasn't really an issue of first-order magnitude, right? The developing countries had already conceded the basic point, which was most unfortunate. So they won. They got it. And now that's international law. But there are, it's not a perfect agreement from the point of the industry, even though they negotiated it. There are a couple of loopholes in it. And the most important one is that it enables, the TRIPS agreement still permits countries to use compulsory licensing. So to again, describe what that is, that enables a government to tell a patent holder, you must license the right to use that patent to a competitor. They will pay you a reasonable royalty for it. So we're not stealing it from you. You're going to get paid for it. But you're going to have competition. So to return to our Bristol-Myers Squibb example, Bristol-Myers Squibb is selling a drug in South Africa. They're selling it, DDI, which is an AIDS drug. They're selling it for too much money. South African government says, you're going to license that to one of our domestic companies. They're going to produce it. They'll pay you 10% royalties or whatever the government determines to be a fair royalty rate. And we're going to have competition. And as everyone knows, the generic competitors are going to sell it for something on the order of one quarter the price of what the patent holder sells it. That's what happens now. When a patent expires and generic competition is introduced in the United States, the price normally falls by between 60 to 80% or so. So compulsory licensing is still this really critically available option for developing countries that want to try to introduce competition and lower prices for consumers for essential medicines. So again, this is a big problem for the industry. There can't be any exceptions. Everybody in the world has to follow the rules that the United States decrees. And they are again asking, they're doing two things. Let me say as an aside, the industry, when I refer to them, is represented through a very powerful trade association in Washington, which used to be called the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association. And it has changed its name now, so that the old acronym was PMA. And they've changed their name now to the Pharmaceutical Researchers and Manufacturers Association. So the acronym is PHARMA. Now, why did that matter? I mean, it's clever, right? Now you can say PHARMA instead of PMA. But what actually, the reason for it was that they want to emphasize that they do research. They want to claim that they actually do, that they make original, important, and unique contributions to drug development, that when other people are developing, copying their drugs, they're stealing them, they're pirating them, because they're not really the researchers who invented the drugs. Now, all this is actually quite amusing because drugs of consequence are overwhelmingly developed by the U.S. government through the National Institutes of Health. About three-quarters of the most important drugs in the last 20 years, for example, were developed by NIH primarily, with only a little bit of add-on at the end by the private industry, even though they get exclusive rights to use it at the end of the day. Anyway, so PHARMA has assisted the U.S. Trade Representative in bringing sanctions or threatening sanctions against Thailand, again the same set of countries, Thailand, Brazil, and Argentina, for their efforts to use compulsory licensing or not fully comply with more than what U.S. demands, which are more than the WTO requires. They're also threatening to use the WTO against the countries that aren't doing all the United States wants, which is to eliminate the possibility of compulsory licensing. But that's a threat, and it's saber-rattling, but they're never going to do it because they know in this case, actually, they would lose. So our position is that we're actually, even though the WTO rules, the TRIPS rules are unfair to developing countries, we're willing to accept that because there's still this one possibility of using compulsory licensing. But we're not. But what can't be demanded is more. So the countries compromised, they basically gave in the TRIPS negotiations. That's enough for the U.S. industry. They shouldn't get any more. The biggest, most important country in resisting has been South Africa, which passed a Medicines Act, which was probably the most progressive thing the Mandela government has done, which permits compulsory licensing. And the U.S. government has done almost everything imaginable for them, including imposing trade sanctions on South Africa to get them to rescind a portion of the Medicines Act, which would enable them to do compulsory licensing. Now, you can imagine they might want to do compulsory licensing because they got an eighth of their population HIV positive. These drugs for AIDS were totally out of reach, and if they use compulsory licensing, they might be able to save the population. So it's not some trivial issue from the point of view of the South African government, but it's not a trivial issue from the point of view of the U.S. industry either. And so they've enlisted, let's say, the U.S. government to go no holds barred against South Africa. And there's recently a report that we got access to that was prepared by the State Department explaining all that the U.S. government has done to beat up on South Africa. So this is an excerpt with how they explain what they've done. They said, all relevant agencies of the U.S. government, the Department of State together with the Department of Commerce, its U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the Office of the United States Trade Representative, the National Security Council, and the Office of the Vice President, have been engaged in an assiduous, concerted campaign to persuade the government of South Africa to withdraw or modify its Medicines Act. So Vice President Gore, working on behalf of Bristol-Myers Squibb, is meeting with Deputy President of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, and telling him, get rid of your Medicines Act, because we don't want you to save people's lives in South Africa. We want you to save Bristol-Myers Squibb's profit line. It's a pretty disgusting issue. The United States has also enlisted the President of France, which Chirac, and the Swiss and German presidents also to raise this issue. Those are all countries that also have strong industries. So this is a pretty outrageous situation. But you have a glimmer of hope at the end of the story. There are a couple of things that are going on to resist it. And the key thing that there's two ways to deal with this. One is to directly pressure the Clinton administration and Gore himself to cut this stuff out. And I think that's going to happen in a significant way. And the other is to have the U.S. Congress cut off money to the administration for use in these purposes. And such a provision was included in an Africa trade bill, which is called the Hope for Africa Bill, that maybe some of you know a little bit about. If that had passed, which it's unlikely it will, but it's still got more support in Congress than really anybody expected. If that had passed, it would have prohibited the U.S. government from spending any money to do these kinds of things. It would have prohibited the government from beating up on any African, from spending money to beat up on any African country to ask them to implement intellectual property rules that are stronger than what are required by the WTO. You follow that? Okay. So we've advanced that pretty well, I think, with the Hope Bill. And the Hope Bill is stalled a little bit right now, as well as the alternative bill that it was trying to defeat, which it's been quite successful in doing. And hopefully there will be a independent bill that will try to do just this, that will include in the appropriations bill for the administration, and that would prohibit them from doing this stuff. And I don't think we're likely to win that this year, but I think we're pretty likely to win it in the near future. And the we is all the traditional trade type people, all the trade coalitions, but also the HIV people with AIDS and the AIDS activists and HIV positive groups in the U.S. have become involved with this now just the last couple months in very exciting ways. So we've had a pretty substantial demonstration by Washington Standards a month ago or so. We had about 1,000 people down to protest on this issue. So I think 1,000 people protesting on intellectual property is pretty good. A little obscure. We closed down the building the farm is in for a little while. We had a couple dozen arrests. Of course, the Washington Post refuses to cover the story because it's inconsequential, because it only affects dying people in Africa, as well as Asia and Latin America. But we did because we had arrests. And we don't have arrests in Washington, we all have arrests out here. They're much more infrequent. So because we had 24 arrests, we were listed in the crime section in the Washington Post. That's what we resort to for the Washington Post. So there's two key web pages if you want to learn more about this stuff and get engaged with this. One is the Public Citizen web page, which is www.tradewatch.org. And the other, where there's much more extensive, very extensive information about this and about compulsory licensing, which is a complicated issue we can talk about at length if you want, is www.cptech.org. CPTECH, which is the Consumer Project on Technology, which is a group that I work in conjunction with. Two final words. One is that if the MAI had passed as draft, had been adopted as drafted, it would have closed this loophole in the WTO, and it would have made compulsory licensing illegal, except under very narrow exception of using it for antitrust purposes. Second, since that's not going to happen, MAI doesn't seem like it's going to move forward as an independent thing, at least as originally formed, the pharmaceutical industry wants to have this problem fixed, the WTO and the new round of negotiations, which they hope to commence at Seattle. So since you all are in the neighborhood, the meeting is going to be in November, and you should all venture up for the varied and interesting and colorful protests that we all expect to take place there, and you know, include this issue in some of your chants.
Okay. Thing would be if you direct your questions to particular people. My name is Charles Gray, and this is Joe Snyder and Rob Weissman. And unless you want all of us to talk about particular questions, is that okay?
I have a question, I guess, either you or Joe. We've been talking about compulsory licensing and intellectual property, but I'm wondering if we are interested in trying to get to the bottom part of the problem, is the best thing to do to protest the MAI and go at it that way, to satisfy as many protests as we can?
One reason I chose to work on the MAI and why I like to is I have very concerns. I'm concerned about poverty, I'm concerned about health and safety, I'm concerned about the environment, and I just didn't know where to go. You know, I feel like I was neglecting one issue if I went and worked on another. But the MAI, of course, everybody's ox. It's bad for the environment, it's bad for wages, it's bad for safety, it's bad for the health, it's bad for everything. So working on that, I've been able to feel like I was working on everything. After stopping the MAI, which seems possible, then I suppose going after, well, first of all, the thing about the MAI is it's sort of a cluster bomb. It's exploding out into these little bomblets because, topical, huh? A lot of the provisions from the MAI are being salted into other trade agreements, like the Clinton's Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which is the one that the Africa Hope Act, which Rob spoke, Jesse Jackson's bill was meant to block. And also there's the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is an extension of NAFTA. It's envisioned to be hemispheric. So these things are winding up everywhere. The thing is to oppose these sort of provisions wherever they show up. And the place where they're made is at the World Trade Organization. And they're made by the office of Charlene Barshefsky, the U.S. Trade Representative, and Clinton Administration. So by opposing not just MAI in particular, but all these sorts of things, all these provisions specifically, and the free trade agenda broadly, I think, is the best one.
The only thing I would have to add is, I think the MAI and the trade treaties are, for many people, a little obscure. So much as I support what you're saying, I would say that there's a lot of sentiment in the United States, and there has been ever since the end of the Civil War, against corporate power as such, and the increases in corporate power. So working in such groups as the Alliance for Democracy or the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, I think is also valuable in capturing again some of the anti-corporate sentiment that keeps arising in the United States when the abuses become so so totally obnoxious. That's all I'm at. So how about up here and then back there?
I believe there was a case challenging NAFTA as a treaty because it didn't have a two-third vote. Does anybody know what's happened with the status of that?
I think it lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. It was just argued, actually. I think last week or the week before. But this is an issue that I've looked. You still working everything. It's an issue I've looked at a little bit, and it's a hard case to win. I mean, on the merit, it's clearly right, but it'd be very difficult to win that case.
Oh, there at the back here.
Just a question. And you said it was a complicated topic, but I hope it's something that you can give me an idea. For instance, in the case of hormonal meat from Europe, which says no, even though the WTO has said we can have to use that, if we don't want to have that America, how Europe is going to move, because everyone's sanctioned trade from Europe. But what exactly would happen, and how well tested is it so that we know if countries are really going to initiate that kind of sanction?
I should have just explained it. The way it works is country loses WTO case. The winning country goes and says, okay, you lost. Change your rules. Fix them. And say the losing country says, okay, we give up. Right, that should be the end of the story. But if they say no, we refuse, then there are two possibilities. One is they can pay a fine, or they can accept trade sanctions. Actually, the winning country can demand payment of a fine or impose trade sanctions. And the trade sanction or the fine is supposed to be equivalent in amount to the lost value of trade as a result of the offending rule. Now, it gets worse than that, because the sanctions, if they are imposed, are not imposed on the same industry that was the beneficiary of the rule. They're imposed on different industries. Which means you get lobbyists in the losing country to change the rule. Now, no one could have followed what I just said, but I'll explain it to you like this. The European Union has trade preferences for bananas from Eastern Caribbean, poor countries, former colonies in the Caribbean. The U.S. says that violates WTO. U.S. brings a case, U.S. wins. The European Union says, too bad, we're not giving in. We love our old colonies. We're going to protect them. Well, they're actually in the right on this, so I shouldn't mock it too much. The United States says, all right, that's hurting us. And by us, nothing to do with anybody in the United States. It's the company of Chiquita only, which produces in, right, as you know, in Central America, not here. Anyway, let's say whatever the amount is. I don't know what the amount is, $100 million. But that might be what it's been claimed. Then the United States trade representative imposes trade sanctions on a variety of European exports to the United States worth $100 million. So, for example, in this case, which actually happened, they were doing things like exotic kinds of cheese, Sheffield sweaters, and other kinds of luxury goods, and basically trying to turn those industries in Europe, which would have been unable to compete in the U.S. market, against the European Union rule to protect the banana producers. And that's still up in the air how that one's going to turn out.
Over here. The question is not for Raj in terms of the WTO compulsory license rule. Just how lax are they? Is it a requirement that as soon as a product goes to market that the license be sold to a competitor? Is there a certain amount of time they have to do that? How does that work?
They're pretty good. There's no time limitation. The big issue that's unclear is whether a country, say South Africa, could do compulsory licensing and then export the product to the rest of Southern Africa. That's a little fuzzy. I think there's probably ways to do that. And that would be important for South Africa probably can produce a drug and justify it for its own market. But if Mozambique wanted to produce the drug, the domestic market may not be big enough unless they can also export to South Africa.
Okay.
When a country challenges a WTO policy like the European Union with the hormone beef, when they're forced to bring the stuff they don't want into the country, is that labeled? Do the consumers have a choice as to whether to buy it or not?
It would vary by what the issue is. I mean, in the case of genetic engineering, the U.S. position is it's a violation of the WTO to label genetically engineered food, but there's no reason to do that.
I
get
a point on that. Monsanto does the bovine growth hormone. In the state of Vermont, passed a law that basically said you have to label this stuff. Monsanto sued them under free speech, saying they have the right not to say that.
But Ben and Jerry still doesn't.
Martin?
Ben and Jerry still doesn't. It says right on the cartons of ice cream that we use no hormone in this house. Okay, other questions? Okay.
Back to the issue of compulsory licensing. So is that in fact what the pharmaceutical companies see as a real threat in South Africa if compulsory licensing continues? These domestic companies eventually will be able to export their more cheaply produced pharmaceuticals to other nations? Because it seems right now, in the short term anyways, if they're not selling any of their own pharmaceuticals there anyways, that why would they not want compulsory licensing so they could at least be receiving royalties? Is that what they view as a real threat, that once a domestically produced pharmaceuticals industry is developed, they can begin exporting and create competition all over Africa?
No, it's not. That's a very good question. The question is, if the pharmaceutical industry isn't selling in Africa anyway, what do they care if somebody else sells? And the answer is, they care about compulsory licensing because it would show that pharmaceuticals could be sold more cheaply, not in Africa, but in the United States. So the total concern is that the model is imported into the United States and into the European Union and lowers prices here.
Profit.
There's a reason the United States invested billions in defeating the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. The model was too back there.
My question is, when you opened up this seminar with the point that the most powerful corporations are those related to transportation, oil, and GM, and automobile, it's my field, and I say that while mass production gets efficient by getting bigger or appealing to the global market, moving to foreign countries where they can lower and become a bigger mass production, the cost of distribution go up. Even though production efficiency increases, distribution costs go up. And so I see for that reason alone that the global economy of import-export production is not sustainable, because we're not going to be able to sustain that kind of transportation just globally.
Yeah. I agree. The transportation costs are going way up as a factor in the total cost of something. And of course, the transportation companies are also part of the lobby. I mean, they're part of the oil industry in a sense. They use so much of it.
As they're looking at the cost increase, how can they not see that they ultimately will? It's not sustainable there at the end of the day. And that many of us probably think in the line of developing local economies. First world economies, our world is not a sustainable economy because we're dependent upon exports, just like the third world is dependent upon exports. That's the direction I think that we should take towards a sustainable development of economies locally. Because our transportation system is increasing the cost of living and messing up the planet at the same time. And ultimately, the global economy will fail for that reason alone. Can you elaborate for me?
Well, I think you've elaborated pretty well. Yeah, I think that it's definitely not sustainable. with a lot of other things that are in our system that are simply not sustainable.
We'll find a way to subsidize it.
Yeah,
I think that's right, and I think the environmental costs are unacceptable. And I think you're right that we have to move towards local economies, but I don't think I agree with the idea that the system's going to collapse on its own because of transportation costs.
Then we have a difference of opinion.
Let me give an example that it shows how insane the calculus is for companies. We didn't really talk about labor costs in this, which is sort of the core issue. But
the roads and the Forest Service.
You all know about the Scrabble story?
No.
Scrabble, you all know what Scrabble is, I assume.
Yeah.
It's made not with Oregon trees. They're made with Vermont trees. And I don't do forest stuff. I forget what kind of tree it is. But anyway, it's a particular kind of tree in Vermont. happens to take the ink, it's a light colored wood, but it takes the ink very well and it can handle the pressure of the stamping. So they like the tree. They've always produced it in Vermont. It's a small factory. There are about 70 people who've been employed in it recently. The Scrabble manufacturer, which I think now is Hasbro, just closed the factory. And they're going to move production to China. So the Scrabble tiles are going to be made in China. But they're going to be made with the trees from Vermont. Now, I can't imagine, I really can't imagine in that case how it's cost efficient. But they think it is.
Well, that's why we have corporate welfare, right?
Corporate welfare.
Right. Of course, some of the labor in China is working for 11 or 12 cents an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they can get huge subsidies, right? So that's how they can do these things. Is that right?
They do get huge subsidies. That one's still a bit of a mystery to me. But in any case, I think it raises questions.
Back here, woman back here in the back row.
Yeah, I actually just wanted to put out an invitation to everybody in the room to come this afternoon to the session. We've been pointing out that the WKO is going to be here in Seattle, and people want to help organize around that and think about what we might do. This is actually a session at 4 o'clock upstairs.
Okay, maybe we have room for one more question.
I'd like the members of the panel, if they could please comment on the position that the world trade agreements, such as GATT, under the auspices of the WTO, are fundamentally illegal in their wording, the way they're made up, because they violate the protections of international law that arose after World War II, especially United Nations documents such as the Nuremberg Charter, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, International Covenant on Civil Political Rights, economic, social, and cultural rights, and so on and so on, conventions for prevention of torture, conventions and punishment of the crime of genocide, elimination of all forms of racism, political rights of women, economic rights and duties of states, Charter 1974, and so on. They have specific wordings in these agreements to eliminate any of these internationally protections, international protections that represent the whole body of law, and that this body of law, this body of international law that's supposed to protect life on the planet, human life, animal life, plant life, and so on, a civil commons that's really in the process of evolution for millennia. It's just being totally disregarded. These are rogue agreements. These are rogue organizations. Could you please?
Everybody here, please comment. Okay. My own reaction is, I agree largely, and I think it's a area where the legal people need to get into the illegality of some of these things. I tend to agree, but they certainly deny the Universal Declaration of Human Rights provisions that provide for the participation of people in the decisions that determine their lives. These agreements simply cut people out because most of them are negotiated by trade representatives who represent largely big business. There are no environmental representatives or one or two perhaps occasionally on these trade delegations. They're almost entirely big business representatives. Their meetings are in secret. They come to their decisions in secret, and we pay the price. Where's our voice? You know. So I agree. There's some other comments on this.
The law seems to be, there's law written, and then there's a lot of it depends on who's doing the interpretation. And right now, those who do the interpretation don't seem to be much accountable to us. Seems to be almost, we're in an Orwellian world where anything can mean anything, because I don't understand the distinction between being fired and being permanently replaced. Things like that. So Rob, talk about that.
As a lawyer. Well, I think, you're totally right, but I don't think that's really a very fruitful road for resisting stuff. As a matter of law, it's probably not correct, because the later agreement is international law would probably just override the others. There's probably also not, in legal terms, a kind of direct contradiction that you see is obvious and you're right about. But as a legal matter, they probably don't contradict in the way you're suggesting.
But doesn't international law, shouldn't it supersede trade agreements?
They are international law.
They are international law.
In fact, they're international law in some ways that have, in most ways, have more importance and meaning than the kind of international law you're referring to.
Couldn't you see it as fruitful try to include, put pressure to include all of these, this body of international law, as we mentioned, in these trade agreements? Because there's nothing in the trade agreements to protect life, to protect the human or any other form of life, or any kind of a civil commons, protection of societies, protection of the environment.
Yes, you're
right.
There's
nothing like that included. The only thing that they not only concentrate on but absolutely adhere to is the protection of money makes more money sequence, it's totally delinked. Any other concerns?
I want, I hate to interrupt, but I'm sure some people are hungry, so I'd like to close the formal thing, and if you have a few things to talk about, like hang out, that's fine, but thank you very much.